Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, I-10 eastbound, an accident at 27th Avenue has the center lane blocked. Also on the 10 eastbound, an accident blocks the shoulder at 16th Street. Look for partly cloudy skies across the valley this afternoon. Slight chance for rain this afternoon. It'll be partly cloudy tonight, 30% chance of rain. Overnight lows near 70. Partly cloudy, 20% chance of rain tomorrow, the high of 88. We have officially hit the forecast high for today of 89 degrees. Today is Election Day in Arizona as voters decide Propositions 123 and 124. And after the long lines and other problems that plagued Arizona's presidential preference election in March, all eyes were on polling places today. KJZZ's Matthew Casey from our West Valley Bureau spent some time earlier today at a polling place near 32nd Avenue in Camelback. He joins me. And Matt, what do you see?
It was pretty quiet at that polling place. There were no lines. I only saw a couple people going in to vote. But it was just before the lunch hour, so more people have probably arrived since then.
What did the folks who were working at the polling place have to say about what they had seen?
They said turnout has been better than some elections, but not as good as others. Certainly nothing like the presidential preference election.
That's KJZZ's Matthew Casey. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Mark.
Something else voters may see at their polling places today, signature gatherers hoping to collect enough to get initiatives referred to November's ballot. That includes Andrew Chavez's company, Petition Partners, and Andrew joins me. So are you guys out at polling places today, Andrew?
Yes, we are actually at about 80 different locations this morning and this afternoon statewide.
Does the fact that Arizona has this special election provide sort of an extra opportunity to get signatures for these things?
It does. It does create a nice extra opportunity for us, unexpected, because of the special election. You have a large concentration in about 2 hours throughout the day, both morning and night, of registered voters that are showing up in their neighborhoods to vote. We are limited by the 75-foot electioneering rule, but in a lot of cases, we're talking about schools, churches that have accessible parking lots. So that's where we remain today.
Were you also sort of out in force during the presidential preference election?
We were. And unfortunately, it created problems for voters having to stand in long lines and, you know, made it difficult for those folks to vote. It created a fantastic opportunity for petitioners. I would have definitely preferred the voters to win out on that one rather than the petitioners. But you did have a large access to registered voters that were standing in lines that were pretty much beholden to anything but their phone or petition circulator. So it worked out pretty well for us then.
So given the fact that there have been two instances where you could collect signatures that in an ordinary year you might not have, does that bring the cost down for folks trying to collect these signatures?
No, not at all. I mean, you're talking about a relatively small percentage of signatures that are gathered during these election days. And in this case, we had two of them, luckily. But, you know, with statewide ballot measures that need upwards of 250 to 400,000 signatures, it's proportionally a relatively low amount of signatures that we gather during the day.
So we shouldn't look for things to be on the ballot in November or candidates to be on the ballot that wouldn't be there absent these kinds of events, because it's so much easier to get signatures when you have sort of this captive audience there.
I think the greatest benefit, to kind of sideways answer your question, the greatest benefit so far has been to legislative candidates, constable candidates, and JP candidates who might not have had an opportunity to go face-to-face with people in their neighborhood, in their precinct, potential constituents, where they can actually meet and greet face-to-face with these folks, opportunities that they wouldn't have had otherwise.
Is it easier to get people to sign a petition when they're already at what is essentially a political event?
Yeah, of course, you know, people go into voting to be civically engaged and definitely have that spirit. I don't know about being any easier. I mean, for us, we're always trying to track down registered voters. So in that case, it presents a fantastic opportunity for us. Most folks are really just wanting to get in and out and not have any more frustration with any more interaction with folks. So it becomes the petitioner's responsibility to engage these folks face-to-face and get them to appreciate what we're doing. In some cases, that's a little bit difficult when you have voters who are trying to rush in and out.
Andrew Chavez is the owner of Petition Partners, out and about today on the special election day. Andrew, thank you very much. Last Friday, federal judge Murray Snow dropped a 162-page order finding Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio in contempt of court. Joining me now to discuss more of the details buried in that long ruling is KJZZ's Jude Javi Block. And Jude, we talked to you on Friday hours after the order came down, but since then you've actually had a chance to read all 162 pages of Snow's findings. What jumped out at you?
Yeah, I admit it took a little while. But after giving it that careful read, a theme emerges. The judge finds that both Arpaio and his chief deputy, Jerry Sheridan, made, quote, multiple intentional misstatements of fact while under oath. And so heading into this contempt hearing, Arpaio and Sheridan had admitted they violated the court orders, but they claim their missteps were not intentional. But in this order, Snow is finding that the violations were knowing and intentional, and the two misrepresented the facts when they tried to make their case on the stand.
That seems like a pretty serious charge for the judge to make.
Right, it is. And there's a crime called perjury out there. And I wanted to know, once a judge accuses a defendant of lying on the stand, what generally happens next? I asked that question to former U.S. Attorney Paul Charlton, who I should mention is a longtime Arpaio critic.
If a judge makes a finding that the head of one of the largest law enforcement agencies in the state made an intentional misrepresentation under oath and did so more than once, that's something that a prosecutor, especially a federal prosecutor, should be paying very close attention to, regardless of whether the judge eventually refers that case to the U.S. Attorney's Office for prosecution.
And Charlton says there could be other consequences. For example, AZ Post, which certifies police officers, could choose to investigate some of the sworn officers who are called out in this order for untruthfulness, though their authority does not extend to Arpaio as the sheriff.
Jude, you'd mentioned on Friday when we first discussed this order that the judge had pretty harsh remarks for the sheriff's internal affairs department. What else can you tell us about that issue?
So the judge actually determined that some of the internal affairs investigations were done in a way to protect sheriff's personnel from discipline rather than getting to the truth. And I spoke with Tom Irvin, a former lawyer for county supervisors who's had his share of clashes with Arpaio, about this order, and this is how he described it.
The internal affairs investigations are critical because what Judge Snow found was that in order to cover up the illegal conduct of the sheriff's office, they whitewashed everything. And he found it was a purposeful whitewash. If somebody was accused of doing something, somebody's friend was appointed to investigate it.
Are there any clues about what the judge wants to do to fix all this, Jude?
Well, I think it's going to be a big theme when all the parties gather on May 31st, this internal affairs issue in particular. They're getting together on May 31st to discuss remedies, and this will be a key point. And what's really remarkable, in this order, the judge decided to void some of the completed internal affairs investigations that have already been finished. And those investigations had to do with the possibility of deputies taking IDs and license plates and money and possessions from Latino drivers. And the judge has raised questions for all the parties about moving forward. How should those investigations be reopened? Would they need to be done by an independent body outside of the control of the sheriff, maybe under the control of the court itself? That, of course, is going to raise all kinds of new complexities because usually there's time limits for these internal investigations. The union representing these officers might complain it's not fair to investigate the same matter twice.
Now, Jude, obviously Sheriff Arpaio has a primary coming in August, and if he remains the Republican candidate, he'll have another election in November where he could win his seventh term. How could the judge's contempt ruling impact popular sentiment towards him?
So Arpaio's critics have been very vocal celebrating this order from Judge Snow, but his supporters feel that this judge is the one who's out of line. There's a letter to that effect in today's Arizona Republic. And if you go to Arpaio's Facebook page, you'll see posts from people who feel that Arpaio was in the right to continue enforcing immigration law even after there was a federal court order to stop. So, I mean, it's kind of anyone's guess at this point, but those are the key questions heading into this election season.
Lots to keep our eyes on. KJZZ's Jude Javi Block. Jude, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The White Tank Mountains are called the jewel of the West Valley. About an hour outside of Phoenix, a lot of people think about the mountain range as the middle of nowhere.
But that's not going to be the case in the near future, according to Ian Dowdy with the White Tank Mountain Conservancy. The
reality is that they're completely surrounded by planned development.
Planned communities in the area surrounding the White Tanks will cover more than 300,000 new single-family homes and could bring up to 1.5 million people to the area, according to Dowdy.
You know, what people don't understand is that the White Tanks in about 30 or 40 years will be completely surrounded by urban development. And the wildlife and the natural scenic resources that exist in that mountain range could well be threatened by that development, cutting off the natural ecological function of that landscape.
The White Tank Mountains Conservancy was formed in 2014 to bring together conservationists, developers, and West Valley cities to balance those environmental concerns with the impending development in the area. And now the City of Surprise is considering joining the Conservancy. The show's Lauren Gilger is here with more on this. And Lauren, are other West Valley cities joining this group?
Yes. In fact, the mayor of Buckeye, Jackie Meck, is the vice chair of the White Tank Mountains Conservancy Board, and Peoria and Youngstown are both members. Now, Surprise is set to discuss joining the Conservancy tonight at their city council meeting. It costs a one-time fee of $25,000 to join, and they've slated that money in the city's 2017 budget. I talked to Eric Fitzer about this. He's the community development director with the City of Surprise, and he says the White Tanks are an asset to the city and to developers.
We do want the development to happen, but we want to make sure that we do it properly when it comes down to it. The idea is, you know, this is a jewel of the West Valley. And we really want to learn from the positives that have happened in the East Valley, you know, adjacent to the McDowell Mountain Preserve. You know, we've really kind of looked at that area as what's the good and bad, what could have been done better, and kind of take into consideration all those items when we're trying to properly plan for our side of the White Tanks.
So what kind of development is slated in Surprise around the White Tanks?
Fitzer says a lot of the land near the White Tanks in Surprise is actually state trust land owned by the Arizona State Land Department. So they're working with them to figure out how to plan future development of those lands while also protecting the White Tanks, and they want to boost the land department's property value. And he says the state is not actually a bad property owner to work with.
You know, the state land department is in no hurry to sell necessarily these lands. So, you know, it's nice to have a property owner such as that to partner with. A lot of times when you're dealing with just private landowners, I know they're in there, they're going to sell right away and get out. The state land department doesn't work that way.
Fitzer says the city wants development out there to look like DC Ranch in Scottsdale or Verado in Buckeye. They want upscale communities that allowed access to the mountain preserve for their residents and for the wider community.
So, Lauren, you said development that's already scheduled could bring up to 300,000 new homes near the White Tanks. What could that do to the environment and the wildlife that's already there?
Right. So this is a mountain range that's incredibly well preserved. They have nearly 30,000 acres of open space, according to the Conservancy, and they have wildlife. There are herds of deer, mountain lions, javelina. So one of the reasons they formed this conservancy in the first place was because they saw it as a real opportunity to shape this impending development that's coming down the line before it's all said and done. Here's Ian Dowdy again with the Conservancy.
You know, there is an adage that the folks in the wildlife community talk about, and they always say there are no deer in Deer Valley. And that's an interesting statement in itself, because if you talk to the old timers in Phoenix, they will talk about the deer that were in Deer Valley, the mule deer that were there, and the hunting and recreation opportunities that existed, you know, several decades ago. And so now in the far West Valley, we're looking at the White Tank Mountains and with a very proactive lens. We're saying, you know, if we can do a better job somehow in protecting the natural resources that are here, we will be leaps and bounds ahead of other portions of the valley that have lost those opportunities.
That's Ian Dowdy with the White Tank Mountains Conservancy. The City of Surprise is scheduled to discuss joining the Conservancy at their city council meeting tonight.
That's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
My pleasure.
Healthcare providers are thinking a lot more about end of life these days, with an emphasis on quality. Controlling pain is a big issue, and having loved ones nearby. In addition to those things, Lahey Hospital near Boston is trying a unique approach to make patients comfortable. Paige Flager from our partners at WHYY has more.
Right now, you're hearing two things. The first is the sound of a harp. It's being played by Jennifer Hollis. The second is the sound of an oxygen tank humming in the corner. A clear tube leads to Susan Steinbauer. She's laying in her hospital bed with her eyes closed, her hands folded over a blue crocheted blanket. She's 64 and has terminal cancer. When the music stops, Steinbauer opens her eyes.
It actually brought me back to a certain place in my childhood that, you know, when you're little, you run so free. And that's what it was. It was like the freedom feeling.
Well, would you like more music? Do you feel like that's enough for now? It's totally up to you.
I could do another one.
Yeah, another one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Jennifer Hollis is more than a harpist. She's what's called a music thanatologist. She plays the harp and sings for dying patients. So, if life was a movie, Hollis plays the music during the closing credits. Her profession is really rare. She's the only music thanatologist in the northeastern United States, and there are less than 100 music thanatologists worldwide. She had never heard about this field until she came across an article back in 1995. She had played music all her life and decided that this was something that she really wanted to explore.
At that point, it sounded very strange to people that someone who was about to graduate from college was going to go off and move from the Boston area. And the only training program at that time in the world was in Missoula, Montana. So my plan was to graduate from college and move to Missoula, which is exactly what I did. So I think that, to me, that sounded like a great adventure.
She took classes in anthropology, music theory, anatomy, and physiology, and she had regular voice and harp lessons. The defining characteristic of music thanatology is what Hollis calls the prescriptive process. She explains that music thanatologists think of the raw elements of music, like melody, harmony, rhythm, and tonality, and then they use those things to respond to different moods of hospital rooms.
So if a patient has restlessness, agitation, I would start thinking prescriptively about what are the qualities of music that might be able to address that in some way.
For the last 10 years, Hollis has been going to Leahy Hospital outside of Boston to play for dying patients. Sometimes the patient response is physical. They might breathe more deeply or their facial expression might relax. More often than not, she'll play a room full of people straight to sleep. But she's not insulted by that.
It's such a compliment because it means that people are, they're relaxed, that they feel safe and they feel comfortable.
Other times, the response to the music is really emotional, and not just for the patients. Families might use this time to tell stories about their loved one, to pray, or to say goodbye.
The interesting thing about music thanatology, I think, is that in some ways it's medicine that you can give both to the patient and to their family.
There's not a whole lot of research backing up the benefits of music thanatology. Beth Collins is the medical director of Leahy Hospital's palliative care program. She says that at first, when she heard about Jennifer Hollis and her work, she was really worried that her unit might be seen as soft or touchy-feely by other doctors. That is, until she saw Jennifer Hollis in action. Then, she didn't really care about the science.
I don't think things have to be proven. I think they just have to work. And to me, my God, this is a heck of a lot better than giving somebody some medication that's going to change things going on in their body. If her work is able to help a heart rate slow down and someone not breathe as hard and be more comfortable, that's better than anything, I think.
Colin says there's only been one complaint about Jennifer Hollis in the time that she's been visiting the hospital.
The only thing is sometimes some patients' families have said, oh my God, no. If my father ever opened his eyes and saw somebody with a harp near his bed, he would think he had already died.
But the harp reminding people of those pearly white gates isn't always a bad thing, Hollis says.
I think for some people, it's evocative in a very positive way, where they love the idea that their loved one, especially if they're not conscious and speaking anymore, might hear the music and feel like they were in heaven.
Susan Steinbauer passed away last month. Paige Flager reported the story for The Pulse, a health and science show. The podcast is on iTunes. It's the show on 91.5 for Tuesday, May 17th. Thanks for listening. Along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry. Today, I'm Mark Brody.
Perhaps a theme of the outgoing Obama administration might be something like mission not accomplished or mission nebulous. Here's the president speaking to U.S. troops at Fort Bragg in 2011 about ending the war in Iraq and lessons learned.
It's harder to end a war than begin one. Indeed, everything that American troops have done in Iraq, all the fighting and all the dying, the bleeding and the building and the training and the partnering, all of it has led to this moment of success.
We know, of course, what happened to that moment of success, the dreamed of peace in Iraq. But what of other conflicts? Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna this week to meet with foreign ministers, and he wants to end a UN arms embargo to Libya imposed in 2011. Here's Secretary Kerry speaking on Monday in Vienna.
The arms embargo does allow for the government of national accord to request weapons if it needs them, specifically to secure the country and to combat Daesh.
Kerry wants U.S. weapons in the war against Daesh or ISIS. Does this arrangement mean U.S. boots on the ground?
We're not talking about troops and boots and that kind of intervention. We're simply in a mode of trying to help and assist and develop a Libyan capacity to be able to respond to the challenge of security within Libya.
Maybe the reason Secretary Kerry said that is that he knows the U.S. already has boots on the ground in Libya. The Washington Post reported last week that two special operations units totaling about 25 people have been stationed in eastern and western Libya since late 2015. There are quite a few boots on the ground in Africa, it turns out. A conference this month in Tanzania confirmed that there are U.S. troops in Uganda, maritime forces in Senegal, troops at a huge base in Djibouti, forces in Ethiopia and Somalia, Burundi, Mauritania. And that's part of a much larger push under President Obama to increase special ops units in Africa to the point where the U.S. military is now involved in over 90% of Africa's 54 countries. A lot of what we know about U.S. forces in Africa comes from the work of Nick Turse, who's author of Tomorrow's Battlefield, U.S. Proxy Wars and Secret Ops in Africa. Also here is William Wexler, who oversaw special operations from the Pentagon during the Obama administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Combating Terrorism from 2012 to 2015. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. William, can I just ask you if generally the scale of what we think are the operations in Africa sounds correct to you? Is it fundamentally different from what went on in the Cold War? Am I characterizing this, close to bullseye here?
I think in general, your characterization is correct, but it might be misinterpreted by people listening. The vast majority of the work that's being done is simple training and liaison work, and that kind of work goes on in country after country around the world and has gone on for decades and decades. What's different about what's going on right now is the common threat that many of these countries are feeling from Salafi jihadists, whether it's Al-Qaeda or whether it's Ansar al-Sharia or whether it's the Islamic State.
But isn't it the case that if those threats become more real, then those troops are right there to be activated and with prepositioned equipment and materiel and communications gear operating from Djibouti, boom, we're in a conflict.
It's certainly possible and certainly something that you have to worry about, but it's unlikely. The fundamental question that that policymakers need to ask themselves is whether sending a small detachment of special operations forces to do the equipping and training and advising and assisting work to help other countries fight their own fight against terrorists is something that prevents the United States from being in a real conflict, or something that is the slippery slope to getting the United States in such a conflict. There have been good experiences that we've had where properly managed, properly overseen, very small deployments of special operations forces actually keep the United States out of such a conflict by enabling the local countries to fight their own wars.
All right, William Wexler, I'm going to come back to you on that precise issue there, but let's get a sense from Nick Turse. What do you think of the scale of U.S. involvement in Africa as you've managed to report this? And we're relying on your numbers here.
Sure. I mean, we've seen exponential growth when it comes to the U.S. military's operations in Africa. You know, when U.S. Africa Command, the umbrella organization for U.S. military activity on the continent, When it began operations back in 2008, it inherited 172 missions, activities, programs, exercises across the continent. By 2013, the combined total of all U.S. activities on the continent reached 546. In 2014, that number leapt to 674. So U.S. troops were carrying out almost two operations, exercises, or activities, from drone strikes to counterinsurgency instruction, intelligence gathering to marksmanship training, somewhere in the continent every single day. So this represents an almost 300% jump in annual activities.
What do you make, Nick, of William Wexler's suggestion that these are all initiatives to actually prevent the U.S. from getting involved in wider warfare and that, in fact, they are insignificant individually?
Well, I think, you know, taken as a whole, you can't say that this is insignificant. I also think that, you know, Mr. Wexler talked about the Vietnam model. I think this is a very, it's very dangerous to have, you know, this many troops pre-positioned all over the continent.
William Wexler, you can respond to what Nick Turris is saying there, but let me just ask you, you said a moment ago that these missions in Africa are designed to prevent the U.S. from getting involved in wider conflicts. Shouldn't there be some other goal of these missions other than to simply prevent the U.S. from being involved? What good comes of these individual missions that we can say is of strategic importance to the U.S. relationship with Africa?
Sure. The strategic importance is the existence of the Salafi jihadists on the continent of Africa. What we've seen time and time again is that when these kinds of terrorists, not all kinds of terrorists, we're not in a war on terror, not all kind of Islamic terrorists, not even all kinds of Sunni Islamic terrorists, but these kinds of terrorists, the Salafi jihadist terrorists, whenever they have a sanctuary from which they can act with impunity, they inevitably and inexorably eventually go to external attacks. And we saw that in Afghanistan, we saw that in Yemen, and we saw that in Syria. And now we're starting to see this, these same groups with these same ideology and the same pressures upon them gaining that kind of sanctuary in places like Libya. And we can wait until they do those external attacks, or we can learn from history and try to approach it in a very different way than the way that Don Rumsfeld approached it. In fact, this is the opposite of how the Bush administration approached it. This is not an occupation. This is not direct action by and large. This is indirect action. This is working by, with, and through others on the ground, people who are indigenous to the area, people who have legitimate governance over the area, and who want to extend that governance over ungoverned areas in order to deny terrorists the ability to commit their terrorist acts. That's a legitimate act from legitimate governments, and they're seeking the United States' help, not the United States to fight their fights, but the United States to help them train, equip, and give them the kind of advice on the basis of our learned skills over the last decade and a half.
William Wexler, thanks so much.
Thank you.
William Wexler oversaw special operations from the Pentagon during the Obama administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Combating Terrorism. Nick Turris is the author of Tomorrow's Battlefield, U.S. Proxy Wars and Secret Ops in Africa. His new book is Next Time They'll Come to Count the Dead, War and Survival in South Sudan. Nick, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. In KJZZ News, thousands of Cuban migrants stranded in Panama are now boarding planes headed to the U.S.-Mexico border. Monica Ortiz Uribe reports they're crossing to the U.S. via El Paso, where local resources are strained.
300 Cuban migrants are arriving in El Paso almost daily. They land in neighboring Ciudad Juarez and are bused by Mexican authorities to the border, where they're processed and released by U.S. customs officers. Ernesto Rodriguez blasts music from an 18-passenger van parked near the border in downtown El Paso. He's with a group of fellow immigrants who banded together to pick up some of the new arrivals. In Cuba, I worked as a taxi driver, he says, but I couldn't earn enough to live well. He left for Miami a year ago, where he's now a driver for Uber. Rodriguez is able to stay thanks to the 1966 Cuban Adjustment Act, which gives Cubans a fast track to U.S. residency. Now that the two countries are reestablishing diplomatic relations, Cubans are coming over in record numbers, fearing their window of opportunity will soon close.
There's a big need for volunteers.
Elizabeth O'Hara is a spokeswoman for the Catholic Diocese, part of a community network in El Paso that assists migrants.
We're doing everything that we can to make sure that people have what they need, but we are getting more people every single day.
Mexico agreed to transport close to 4,000 Cuban migrants from Panama this month. Each migrant must pay $800 for the flight. Monica Ortiz Uribe, KJZZ News, El Paso.
The superintendent of Grand Canyon National Park has chosen retirement over a transfer after being told the park needed new leadership. The decision came months after federal investigators found a long-standing pattern of sexual harassment in the Grand Canyon's former River District. Dave Ubaraga told employees in an email today that he declined an offer from National Park Service Director John Jarvis to transfer to Washington, D.C. Instead, he's retiring effective June 1st. It's unclear who will succeed Ubaraga. Keep your cell phone out of reach if you're driving through Pima County in southern Arizona. KJZZ's Catherine Fritke reports.
In a unanimous vote, the Pima County Board of Supervisors has approved an ordinance banning the use of cell phones while driving. The city of Tucson in Pima County already has a texting ban in place. The Arizona legislature has not enacted any law regulating cell phone use while driving. The Pima County law will go into effect next month. Catherine Fritke, KJZZ News.
A recent study published in the journal Obesity has been generating a lot of buzz. It looked at contestants on a season of the TV show The Biggest Loser and found some startling results. The controversial show encourages contestants to lose as much weight as possible over the course of the season. And the study found participants' metabolism changed drastically afterwards, making it so their bodies actually fought to regain the weight. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry spoke with one of the show's winners who used to live in Arizona.
Allie Vincent won season 5 8 years ago. She lost 112 pounds, and she kept the weight off for about 6 years. She stayed really fit. She completed an Ironman. But over the last couple of years, she's gained a lot of the weight back. And for her, this has really created a lot of shame and made her depression much worse.
I have always struggled with depression and just the pressure of feeling like people are looking at my weight and stuff. And I just started to kind of not go outside, really, you know, just kind of stay in with my group of friends, people I knew, or in my house or whatever. And my weight just started to get out of control. And I also think that it, ironically enough, because I was finally like safe and happy in my relationship and I didn't have all these things. Like I had been pretty much going nonstop for 8 years. And then once I started to gain weight again, because it was already something that I had been struggling with for about a year, you know, I just started to get really depressed and then felt out of control, and then just it perpetuated itself. It was actually this last April 15th that I kind of posted on Facebook. I kind of came out, if you will, that I had gained my weight back from being on the show. But for me, it was a way to just kind of help to try to let go of the shame I felt, because I felt like the shame was killing me. It was making everything worse. It was compounding it. It was making me not want to go outside, not want to see people. I was so afraid of and so ashamed of how I had let myself gain my weight again that I wasn't allowing myself the opportunity to do something about it.
So, you know, you mentioned that you had struggled with depression throughout a lot of your life, and when you started gaining weight back and some of your depression set in, it became a challenge to kind of pull yourself out of that. Do you think that because you've been thinking for so many years about your weight and your health and maintaining this weight loss, and you were a very, very public figure who lost a mass quantity of weight in front of a lot of people, getting to a place where, for whatever reasons, you ended up gaining weight back, like, did that contribute to sort of the depression and the way that you felt about yourself?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that it totally, I mean, I struggled with depression before, and then just with all this pressure and beating myself up and just getting even more depressed and feeling like I can't go outside. I don't want to see people. I don't want people to judge me. I've been on medication for depression and anxiety since The Biggest Loser. I have struggled with depression before The Biggest Loser. I never really noticed any anxiety before The Biggest Loser, but it was like a double-edged sword. Like, I was depressed, so I wasn't moving. Because I wasn't moving, I was gaining weight, which was causing more depression. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
It was like this cycle that I struggled with.
There have been a lot of criticisms in the media, especially recently, yeah, of The Biggest Loser. After having been through the experience and then being where you're at now, do you regret being on the show?
Absolutely not. I do not regret being on The Biggest Loser. The Biggest Loser gave me a lot of gifts. It gave me the opportunity to know that I can do anything that I put my mind to. It gave me the confidence to really push myself to levels I didn't know I was capable of. It's funny because people would ask me afterwards, would you ever do The Biggest Loser again? I'd be like, oh, heck no. Like, I would never. I would never even tell anybody I love to go on it. Like, you know what I mean? Because I had no idea. Like, going into it, I just wanted to feel better about myself. I had no idea, like, how much pain and pressure and, you know, just, I was went on The Biggest Loser because I was overweight, but I had left The Biggest Loser completely food obsessed. Before The Biggest Loser, I would say, like, I don't even know what I eat. Obviously I did, because I weighed 234 pounds, but it was not something I necessarily thought about a lot. But when I left The Biggest Loser, all I thought about was how many calories going in, how many calories going out, when am I going to burn this, how am I going to do that, how much fuel do I need for this activity? Like, literally, like, that's all I thought about. I hope that, like, if they continue with The Biggest Loser, that they find a way to gauge it differently so that it's not just based on weight. But I've always felt like it was about being strong after winning the show.
That was Allie Vincent, winner of season 5 of The Biggest Loser. And to help us understand some of the science behind weight gain and The Biggest Loser study, I spoke with Pam Swan, a professor of exercise and wellness at ASU, who does a lot of research on metabolism. She said that a huge percentage of people who lose a mass quantity of weight will gain it back.
So you go in thinking that you're going to be the one that's going to keep it off, that you're going to be the one. And so your psychology says, I need this off, and I'm going to get it off, and I've worked really hard to get it off. And then your whole body is such, I mean, you see the metabolism data. You see these hormones that are powerful, powerful stimulants of eating and of hunger, and of it shuts your metabolism down. And so that anything you do eat, you gain. You just do. And so it's not her fault that she's gained her weight back. And yet, she's feeling shamed. So it's almost worse to lose and then gain it back than to stay fat.
I guess I'm having trouble sort of breaking apart how much of the negative effects are physical and how much of the negative effects are emotional.
Okay, so in fact, this is interesting research, actually. This is just sort of coming to play. So the effect of stress. You know about stress, right? Stress is bad for you. It causes all kinds of problems. And one of the things that stress does is it causes you to be hungry. Another thing it does is it causes you to actually gain fat in that visceral area. And that visceral area is what causes you to have those negative cardiovascular and metabolic and diabetic and all of those things that we associate with disease. We can actually say it's not obesity itself, it's the stress, because the stress is causing the fatness. Okay, so you have stress going on. Well, one of the things that happens is that when you are stressed, it also, like I said, it causes you to be hungry, but the diet, when you start dieting, when you actually go through, that causes stress as well. In other words, the stress, it's a powerful psychological stimulant when you diet in your brain to say, you need sugar, your body needs sugar, and you are going to then cause your body to create that stress hormone that creates this negative cycle. So in fact, the diet itself causes the stress response.
So for someone who is overweight or is obese, who decides that they want to lose weight,
mm-hmm,
is there a way to approach it that can protect kind of your mental health and maybe avoid those feelings of shame and failure?
That's a good question, yeah. The first and number one thing to understand is that it's not about the weight, okay? So in other words, the weight is got to be secondary. If all it was weight, then like I said, I mean, I tell this to my students, you know, you could cut off your left leg and you'd lose 20, 30 pounds and you'd be perfectly fine. If it was just the weight. And in fact, what they have to do is shift their mentality first. Meanwhile, you should be doing exercise. And exercise is the key. Absolutely, 100%. It's not about energy expenditure, though. Like, this is really important to understand. The exercise that you do while you're in a quote-unquote weight loss phase or any of that stuff, it's not because you're burning calories. But in fact, what you're doing is you're changing your metabolism. You're changing your muscle's ability to do contraction. You're improving the hormones that are circulating through your body. In other words, it's not about just the calories in and calories out. It's changing your muscles. And once you've changed your mind and once you've changed your muscles, pretty soon that weight will come off and it'll be a lifestyle approach.
That's Pam Swan, a professor of exercise and wellness at ASU.
And that's KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Phoenix Approach, good morning. Challenger 88 November, November 10,000 November.
Challenger 88 November, November, Phoenix Approach. Do you park on the south side or the north side of the airport?
South side for 88 November, November, Swift.
Challenger 8 November, November, roger.
Air traffic controllers help make sure planes keep a safe distance and don't run into each other, among other things. But what about space? Who makes sure all the stuff floating above the Earth keeps a safe distance? Mariba Jha may just be that person. He's the director of Space Object Behavioral Sciences at the University of Arizona and has been called a space traffic controller.
Basically, my role is to lead a research initiative that attempts to quantify, assess, and predict the behavior of all objects in space, both natural and man-made.
What's the utility of knowing what space objects are doing and what they might do down the road?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, when we talk about man-made space objects, the Department of Defense has developed and maintains a catalog of about 22,000 man-made space objects the size of a softball and larger. And out of the 22,000, about 1,200 work and everything else is garbage. It's space debris. It's junk. And the population of junk is growing. We don't totally understand everything that contributes to the growth of that population. And one thing that's pretty critical is that we can't accurately predict when collisions are going to happen between space objects.
As more and more private companies are exploring space and taking people into space, I'm curious what the relationship is between what you're doing and what those companies may need.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, all these private companies, I mean, they want to provide services and capabilities that leverage free use of space. And, you know, none of those services and capabilities are guaranteed. How do you protect that? How do you try to mitigate the loss, degradation, or disruption of those services and capabilities? And so what we're trying to do is work very closely with private industry, recognizing that private industry doesn't have the scope, the bandwidth, or the charter to do the science and technology development and research necessarily to come up with, you know, best of breed kind of solutions. And so our role is to work very closely with private industry and say, hey, we have some technology, some science that we can then transfer to you so that you can insert that directly into your own operational environments and your own revenue kind of thought process and help you be more successful.
What do you think success looks like for what you do? I mean, is it possible to prevent all collisions of space objects?
No. So the ones that you can prevent are the collisions that would happen between something that's dead and something that's active, or two things that are active. And when I say active, things that are maneuverable. In the cases where it's, you know, debris on debris, there's no easy way to prevent that.
So if you see that two bodies are on a collision course, what do you do to try to make sure it doesn't happen?
Right. And so the thing that we are instantiating at the University of Arizona is kind of a coalition of the willing, being thought leaders in the community and having some sort of web presence such that we can have a community that talks to each other, communicates very effectively, and when anything seems to be on a collision path with something else, basically make that very openly accessible and knowledgeable to the rest of the community such that people that could be effective could take some action.
You're basically crowdsourcing it.
Absolutely.
And what kind of actions can one take from Earth to try to prevent two objects from colliding?
Right. So, I mean, if one of the things colliding is something that can be maneuvered, then the people that own that asset could then do a propulsive maneuver and change their orbit, even just, you know, ever so slightly, such that you're now on a missed distance and not on a collision kind of path. And if it's things that can't maneuver, you have people that have, you know, laser systems. And so these are people that can take laser systems and nudge one of the pieces of debris if it's sufficiently small away, kind of thing.
Moriba Jha is Director of Space Object Behavioral Sciences at the University of Arizona. Moriba, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here's an interesting Help Wanted ad we saw. The Phoenix Veterans Day Parade is seeking 7 Grand Marshals. As the saying goes, everybody loves a parade, perhaps none more than the person who's honored with the title of Grand Marshal. But what does that title mean? What are they marshaling and what's so grand about it? Those questions had us scratching our heads, so the show's Annika Klein found some answers.
Let's start with one of the longest-running parades in the country. The Rose Parade.
Well, the concept of a Grand Marshal in a parade was actually, from every historical fact we can find, was actually born in Pasadena, California.
Bill Flynn is executive director of the Tournament of Roses, which puts on the parade, and he says their first Grand Marshal dates back to their first parade. The year was 1890, and parades were much more about horses than about floats plastered with papier-mâché. Flynn says it was common for the equestrian units to have marshals.
And instead of having all of these different marshals, the Tournament of Roses organizers decided we need a Grand Marshal to kind of marshal them all.
It was a very functional post. The first Grand Marshal filled the position for 7 different Rose Parades, riding up and down, keeping every man and horse in line. Then the Roaring Twenties hit.
The Tournament of Roses turned this into more of an honorary position.
No horseback experience necessary.
These are usually individuals who were significant in their particular world, including U.S. presidents, astronauts, veterans, sports figures, movie figures. On the gorgeous, loading
puppet, we trip through a candy shop. Shirley Temple was Grand Marshal of the Rose Parade 3 times, joining the likes of Richard Nixon, Arnold Palmer, and Kermit the Frog. A Grand Marshal became someone who the audience could look up to, both literally and figuratively.
Well, I think one of the things about parades is that they can serve so many different purposes.
Orrin Starn is a professor of cultural anthropology at Duke University.
So you can use them to celebrate a victory in war, or you can use them to celebrate a saint's day. You can use them for political purposes, the March on Washington, a gay rights march.
Starn says parades are huge communal celebrations where people gather to celebrate one identity. And that experience is what still pulls the audience in year after year. And to them, the Grand Marshal may be just one small part of a bigger, louder, more colorful picture. Sometimes, the position of Grand Marshal is most important to the person holding the title.
My story starts in 1951.
Long before Pete Haas was a Grand Marshal in the Phoenix Veterans Day Parade, he was drafted into the Army.
We were shipped directly to Korea.
Haas came home wounded and unwelcome after an unpopular war.
When we came back, people turned their back to us.
In 2008, he was in the Veterans Day Parade for the first time.
As soon as the parade left the staging area, somebody yelled, "Thank you for your service." It was the first time in over 50 years that I heard that.
Haas became a parade Grand Marshal in 2012. He calls it the greatest honor of his life.
And my PTSD and the nightmares that I lived with for so many years went away.
Once a thankless job to organize men on horseback, the title of Grand Marshal today is one that's all about things. Thank you for your service, contributions, legacy left behind. Take it from this former Rose Parade Grand Marshal.
Thank you. 2 of the best words we can ever learn.
For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.